kiss thy hand, but not in flattery, Caesar. Desiring thee that Publius Cimber may have an immediate freedom of repeal.
What? Brutus?
Pardon, Caesar.
Caesar, pardon.
As low as to thy foot doth Cassius fall, to beg enfranchisement for Publius Cimber.
I could be well moved if I were as you. If I could pray to move, prayers would move me. But I am constant as the northern star, of whose true fixed and resting quality there is no fellow in the firmament. The skies are painted with unnumbered sparks. They are all fire, and every one doth shine. But there's but one in all doth hold his place. So in the world, it is furnished well with men, and men of flesh and blood and apprehensive. Yet in the number I do know but one that unassailable holds on his rank unshaped of motion. And that I am he, let me a little show it, even in this. That I was constant, Cimber should be banished, and constant do remain to keep him so.
O Caesar!
Hence, wilt thou lift up Olympus?
Great Caesar!
Doth not Brutus bootless kneel?
Speak hands for me!
Et tu, Brute. Then fall, Caesar.
Oh. Liberty! Freedom! Tyranny is dead! Run hence, proclaim! Cry it about the streets!
William Shakespeare's account of the assassination of Julius Caesar on the Ides of March, 44 BC, is probably the most eloquent version of that historical event. Sir Ralph Richardson was Caesar in that rendition. We heard also Anthony Quail as Brutus, Michael Gwynn as Casca, Nigel Davenport as Decius Brutus, and Douglas Muir as Cinna. Julius Caesar, by Shakespeare's reckoning, and his own, was strong, inflexible, and proud. But what was Julius Caesar really like? I'm Norman Gilliland.
And I'm Emily Auerbach. This is University of the Year.
How ambitious and how ruthless was Caesar? And once he got to the top of the Roman power structure, did he miscalculate what it took to stay there? Who was the first to question his usefulness to the Roman state? Taking us back to Rome as it was more than 2,000 years ago, is Jeff Benneker, professor with the Department of Classics at the University of Wisconsin-Madison.
Welcome to University of the Year.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Well, on this Ides of March, I'm thinking of Brutus in Shakespeare's play later on says, "Remember March, the Ides of March, remember," and refers to Julius Caesar as the foremost man of all this world. Did Julius Caesar earn that reputation as such an important man?
I think he did, especially in retrospect, certainly writing from Shakespeare's time, but even in the, say, the century that followed, the idea of the importance of Caesar really developed. And he became a figure that loomed large over the story of the Republic as it turned into the Empire, and especially the story of the Empire. But at the time, I'm not sure that he would have been recognized as that sort of figure. He was one of a series and maybe the most powerful in that series, but certainly one of a series who had stepped forward and really taken control of Roman politics for a time and then had either stepped aside voluntarily or been pushed aside. So if Brutus really said that, he was prescient in seeing far ahead about the effects of Caesar's political career and ultimately the groundwork that he laid for the coming of the empire.
For some reason, when I read about Roman politics of 2,000 years ago or so, I keep thinking of what it would be like to be in the mafia today. I mean, it seems like the personalities and the way of dealing with problems are very much the same.
I think that's right. And there's a fantastic scene at the beginning of the first Godfather film when they're at the baptism, but all the attention is focused on the Godfather, and there's a long line of people waiting to ask him for a favor. And Roman politics worked very much in that way. There weren't parties as we know them, but there were individuals who attracted what they called clients, and they would act as patrons. And so they would do favors for these clients, support them in a real estate case or something they needed to get done through the bureaucracy of the Roman government. And in return, they expected support in elections and when proposals were put forward and things like that. So it was very much of a patron-client system, very much run like the mafia. And you had individuals sort of pop up and like dons or things like that. And the Republic was designed to keep these individuals on a level playing field, but it was awfully difficult. And that's ultimately what did in the Republic.
Well, give us Julius Caesar's background then, how he went from boyhood into this position of tremendous power.
He was born into a system that was already, depending on, again, from maybe looking back on it, coming apart, but at least under a lot of stress and a lot of pressure. He was born, conveniently enough for us, in the year 100. Most people agree, so it makes it easy to remember. But it was at a time when the populist politicians, politicians who were looking to issues that were important to the mass of people, and Rome had developed a large urban poor, people who had moved off the farms into the city, that could be used to create a political base. And several people in the immediate past for Caesar had been actually killed as part of the political give and take as they became populists. But Caesar's uncle was Marius, and Marius was the first to recruit an army and pay his army out of this urban poor. And so Caesar was born into this very populist family, or at least had a populist bent. And as he was growing up, and when he was in his teens, for example, a man named Sulla marched on Rome. He was the first Roman to march on Rome to claim what he thought was his political rights that had been denied by people, by his political opponents. And so he convinced his army to actually march across. There's a boundary around the city called the Pomerium, which Roman armies were never allowed to cross. But he took his army across that, convinced them, his men, that they had been wrong politically, and took control of the government, went off and did the campaign that he'd been hoping to do, came back and established himself as dictator for a period of years in order, as he would say, to reform the government. And he did. He sort of set the Republic back to being what he thought it should be and then stepped aside. This is the environment. Then Caesar was growing up. Caesar was a teenager at this time and happened to be married to the daughter of Sulla's political opponent. And so he was right in the mix of it from the very beginning, and forced even into exile when he refused to give up his wife at Sulla's command. And so this is his upbringing, and this is, I think, maybe, I doubt Caesar ever had a view of the Republic working as it should have in theory, you know, in a textbook Republic. For him, it was always about developing a power base and then using that power base to push your career forward.
How did he go about developing a power base? I mean, if we take him from his teens onward, is he already a military figure?
Not an outstanding military figure. He did what most other Roman teenagers of his class would have done. Those that were interested in a public career would have very early on started training in the forum, and that is in the courts, to become public speakers, and probably would have the Romans were big into what we would call frivolous prosecution. It was once you sort of felt your strength as a public speaker, you would immediately take someone to court, prosecute them. And even if you lost, that was okay as long as you acquitted yourself well. And so Caesar did that at a young age, like most politicians or like most budding politicians. And he also went off and served as a junior officer abroad, like most men his age would have done. And he didn't do anything particularly outstanding. He just sort of went through the normal give and take. It's more his view when he gets back, when he decides or has to decide how is he going to advance his career, that he really decides to become a populist and support what are essentially agrarian reform, and that is land distributions to help this urban poor get back on the land and have some income rather than being stuck in poverty in the city.
Where do you think his ambition came from? Any evidence of that? Because he's portrayed everywhere as having just undaunted ambition.
It's hard to say. It could have been innate, and even though Caesar is a product of his time, we don't want to deny that he was a special sort of figure and certainly willing to go farther than anyone else had been and able to. When ancient writers write about him, they often comment on his speed. He crossed the Alps, for example, with his army at a ridiculously fast pace. He was known to dictate letters two at a time while on horseback. And he wrote the commentaries that we'll read from while on campaign. But while he was on campaign, not only writing military commentaries, he wrote a treatise on Latin style. And so he seemed to be almost unstoppable, to have unquenchable energy.
Is it true he had epilepsy?
Yeah, it seems that he did have epilepsy. And I think in the movie Antony and Cleopatra, there's a very dramatic scene where he suffers. But I think it may well have been confined to his younger days. It certainly wasn't debilitating for him.
So how much do those writings help his career? I mean, what would be the market, so to speak, for something like war commentaries?
I think it was and commentaries is exactly the right word, and it was fairly regular for politicians, and politicians in generals were the same people. They would be running for office in Rome and then serving abroad as generals, to write commentaries about their service in order to report back to the government in Rome what they had been doing, but also to build their political careers, because oftentimes they would go out into the field, do something spectacular, whether it be to secure a province or maybe expand Roman control into areas where they hadn't had it before, and then come back and turn that into political capital, run for high office, or perhaps get another special command. So it's hard to know exactly who was reading it, but we should assume that almost everyone knew what was going on when Caesar was abroad, either by reading his commentaries or reading letters that were coming back. We know that the Romans wrote lots of letters, lots of correspondence. So, for example, when Caesar is in Gaul, not only is he writing his version of events back, but all the junior officers who are with him, who are essentially repeating the same sort of career steps he had followed, are also writing back reports to their friends and their political allies.
Do they tally pretty well?
Well, fortunately for Caesar, we don't have a lot of that left. So we get Caesar's point of view mostly. But we do have, especially Cicero has a large correspondence that's been left over. And so it gives us sometimes another view of what's going on. But in general, because there were so many people with Caesar able to report on what he was doing, it would have been hard for him to bend the truth too much.
His commentaries on the Gallic Wars are, for whatever reason, probably the most famous Latin sentences, the first couple of sentences of his commentaries where he's actually setting out the map for you.
Yeah, that's right. In some ways, his prose is so straightforward and therefore so easy to read for people who are studying Latin, he actually becomes a bit of what's normally called a schoolboy text, where students read him in early Latin and then tend to associate him with their early days in Latin, so as not being a sophisticated writer. But in fact, he was considered to be a very good writer and someone who knew Latin very well and was an expert in his use of Latin.
He's pretty good with the play-by-play too, though. I mean, describing very specific military maneuvers, like everybody forms what do they call the turtle shell with their shields as
a
defensive
right.
structure when they're attacking and that kind of thing. How does that open in Latin?
Gallia est omnis divisa in partes tres, quorum unam incolunt Belgae, alium Aquitani, tertiam, qui ipsorum lingua Celtae, nostra Galli appellantur. Hi omnes lingua institutis legibus inter se deferunt.
So the three various regions there with their differing languages, but give us a better gloss than that.
Yeah, it starts out, Gaul as a whole is divided into three parts. One of which is inhabited by the Belgae or the Belgians, and that is the region we think of as northern France and Belgium today. Another by the Aquitani, which would be southern France. And a third by a people called in their own language the Celts, but in Latin the Gauls. All these are different from one another in language, institutions, and laws. And then he goes on to elaborate the rivers that divide them, and he gives a little bit of maybe his bias as to what makes people good and not so good in character. He says that of all of them, the Belgians are the hardiest because they live farthest away from civilization. And so they haven't been corrupted. Yeah, they're not influenced by and he calls them the traitors that come and they bring all the things of civilization that soften people up. And because they're up there contending with the Germans who are across the Rhine, they tend to be from his point of view, and I guess he was out there fighting them, maybe the hardiest of the people of Gaul.
And what can you tell about Julius Caesar's personality and outlook from his writing?
And this is sort of the take of him at the time, and I think it's sort of been agreed. A strong man, and let's say, as we talked about, being fast and ambitious, but also courageous and daring and willing and desiring to push the boundaries of his province, even at the expense of hundreds of thousands of lives of these Gallic tribes that he talks about. And he talks about them, some of them in admiring terms, even as he fights them and kills them off. And the numbers have been, it's hard to know, but it may be as many as 500,000, it may be as many as 1 million people from these Gallic tribes died in Western Europe as a result of his campaigns.
And is he boastful?
I would say he's within the limits that would be acceptable for someone who is reporting on what are outstanding deeds and trying to advance his career. So no more boastful than our modern politicians when they talk about all that they've accomplished in their careers and as they try to run for further office.
What was the size and scope of the Roman Empire at this point? What were the opportunities when Caesar came along for expansion?
Well, and this is it. It's an opportunity for expansion. His main political rival was Pompey. And Pompey really was sort of a prodigy. He came on very early and had great military successes. He was part of the slave war against Spartacus in the Italian peninsula. He had successes under Sulla and then in Spain. But then his big accomplishment was to go off to the east and fight a man named Mithridates. But in doing so, he added much of Asia and what we think of as the Middle East, Syria and Palestine, to the Roman Empire. And he, I think, more than doubled the annual income of the empire. And so Caesar was looking for something that he could do that would be equivalent to this. And at the time, the northern provinces, those in northwestern Europe, consisted of Spain, which they had inherited as a result of the Punic Wars, and then a very small province at the top of the Italian peninsula called Cisalpine Gaul, Gaul on this side of the Alps, and then a small one, Transalpine Gaul. But all the rest was untamed. And so it was Caesar's ambition. And some people wonder, did he use the problems that were going on there as an excuse to say he needed to secure the northern border, or was he looking for an opportunity? But one way or the other, he pushed Roman control all the way to the northwestern coast of Europe. And he even is the first Roman to cross the English Channel to Britain. He didn't do much, accomplish much there, but he crossed twice, typically got into a fight and left.
How did he get to be part of the first triumvirate?
The first triumvirate is there were two triumvirates, obviously, the first and the second. The second was a legitimate office that was granted by the Roman government to three men to settle things during a time of civil war. The first triumvirate between Caesar, his rival Pompey, or his, at that time his ally, and Marcus Crassus was a backroom deal. Both Pompey and Crassus had been thwarted in their political ambitions. They had gone fairly far, but there was more they wanted. And Caesar, likewise, was looking to move ahead. And at the time, he was the junior of the three. And so they made a backroom deal that if Caesar would be elected, if they would work for Caesar's election as consul, which is the highest office in the Roman state, for the year 59, that he would further their interests. Pompey had an interest in having his soldiers from this campaign in Asia settled on land, and Crassus had some dealing with tax collectors that he wanted ratified by the Senate. And so the deal was they would work to get their clients to vote for Caesar, put him into office, and then Caesar would help them with their political agenda.
Sounds like Chicago or something.
It's exactly that sort of thing. It's backroom deal making. And again, the ancient writers looking back said that the triumvirate was the beginning of the end of the republic, when people stopped dealing with each other on in an open way by debate and by putting ideas forward and letting them be voted up and down, but instead started making backroom deals. It included an alliance of marriage. Pompey, although he was in his 50s, married Caesar's young daughter, who was maybe around 20. And so the political alliance was cemented, just like we think of royal alliances being put together.
We'll follow Caesar's rise to the top of the Roman power structure when we return in a moment. This is University of the Air. Then he turned in the direction of Ariminium, and when he arrived at the river that divides Cisalpine Gaul from the rest of Italy, called the Rubicon, a reasoning came upon him as he drew even closer to the awesome deed and was bewildered by the magnitude of what he was daring to do. So he stopped his cart. Having halted the journey, he debated repeatedly within himself, silently taking one decision, then the other. And at that time, his conclusion changed over and over. And for some time, he shared his doubts with those of his friends who were present, including Asinius Pollio, calculating what great evils the crossing would bring to all people and how great a reputation they would leave to future generations. Finally, with a certain spirit, as if casting himself away from his reckoning and toward the future, and uttering that saying which is common to men who are entering into uncertain fortunes and daring deeds, "Let the die be cast," he rushed across the river. He completed the rest of his journey at a run, and then fell upon Ariminium before dawn and took the city. On the night before his crossing, he is said to have seen a strange dream. He appeared to be lying with his own mother. The unspeakable union. That's the commentary of Plutarch in his Life of Caesar, describing one of the most notable events in history and certainly a milestone, literally, in the life of Julius Caesar, whose life we're discussing on this 15th of March. I'm Norman Gilliland, back with Emily Auerbach and our guest, Jeff Benneker. We have gotten Caesar into this triumvirate as a fairly young man and something of a military commentator, certainly if not a hero yet at this point. What gets him to this point where he's making a life and death decision?
Well, the Rubicon is the river, and I should point out that we don't actually know which river it is in northern Italy, but it was the river that divided his province of Gaul from the Italian peninsula. And so whenever someone was given command of an army in a province, one of the stipulations was that that army could not be taken outside of that province. And so by crossing the Rubicon, by crossing the boundary, Caesar was effectively declaring war on the Roman state. And he was doing it, he argued in another commentary on his civil wars, to protect his political rights that had been denied back in Rome by the Senate. The Senate at that time had started supporting Pompey against Caesar and had been working to try to get Caesar to lay down his command. Caesar was working to be able to come back to Rome and run for consul again. The Romans had the same sort of rule that we had. While you were in office, you couldn't be prosecuted for actions taken as a magistrate or a government official. But once you laid down your office, you were open to prosecution. And so Caesar was hoping to hang on to his command in Gaul and run for consul at the same time so that he could pass from general to consul without having this period where he was susceptible to prosecution. And his enemies had threatened to prosecute him. But things were not going his way, and he felt that the only way he could get justice, to look at it from his point of view, was to take his army south toward the city of Rome, as Sulla had done, and we talked about the examples from his youth, as Sulla had done, to sort of claim or hold on to what he thought was his political right.
Why did Pompey have the support of the legislature?
Good question. They didn't necessarily like Pompey all that much, but while Caesar was in Gaul, and he was in Gaul for almost 10 years, a lot had changed in the political situation back in Rome. Crassus, the third member of the triumvirate, had died. He had gone off to Parthia, which is the modern-day Iraq and places east of that, to try to have his own great command so he could sort of build up his status, but he died. And so that really left Caesar and Pompey as the two leading figures. And once the third person was gone, it was much easier for these two men to become rivals rather than cooperate. Also, Julia had died in childbirth. So not only was the marriage that had cemented this union together, but the child that might have been sort of the living embodiment of the union was gone as well. And so the political divisions opened up, and Caesar was on one side, and so the people who were supporting the Republic, we might say, naturally gravitated toward Pompey. He wasn't their favorite, but he was the best they had.
It sounds as if these armies tended to be loyal to their commander.
It is, and this is the great reform of the uncle of Caesar, Marius. When the person raising the armies begins to pay the armies, and there's a question, are they loyal to the state or are they loyal to the general who's paying them? And Caesar's army men had become very, very wealthy in Gaul from sacking the towns. And in fact, two of his legions had been taken away from him by the Senate. And when he sent them home, he sent each man home, and a legion had between 4,000 and 5,000 men. He sent each man home with a year's extra pay to ensure that even when they went back and left his direct command, that they would stay loyal to him.
When we opened this part with the reading from Plutarch describing the crossing of the Rubicon, and it seems difficult to tell what's historical fact as opposed to sort of embellishment. For example, that part about the dream where he's lying with his own mother and just sort of what was said at the crossing of the Rubicon. Isn't it difficult to tell what's myth and what's history?
It's very difficult, especially when Plutarch is, first of all, writing about the year 100 AD, so maybe 160 years, let's say, after the event. And the world has changed. The Republic has gone away and the Empire has risen up. And this is one of those seminal events, George Washington crossing the river or something like that, that sort of becomes elevated from retrospective. He is also writing biography, and he says very clearly at the beginning of his book, and he combines Alexander the Great and Julius Caesar into a single book, so you know he's putting Caesar on par with another one of these great generals. But he says at the beginning, I'm not writing histories, I'm writing biographies. And so he's interested in the revelation of character, he says, as opposed to the narration of historical facts. And so a very good question. What we're getting a look at, I think, from Plutarch's perspective here is what Caesar was like. And that's more important, I think, than what he did. And so the question of the dream, for example, is not something Plutarch invents because we know it from other sources. Other people reported that he had this dream. But Plutarch doesn't give us any sort of interpretation beyond the unspeakable union. And so as Caesar is crossing the river, and when he says, let the die be cast, what he's saying is, I really don't know what's going to happen. He's got this, as Plutarch narrates, this reasoning, and he's going back and forth. Should I stay above the river in the north, or should I cross and start the civil war? And in the end, he says, I don't know which is best. I'm going to let fortune decide. I'm going to throw the dice. And so this dream of sleeping with his mother, this unspeakable union, adds further trouble to it. Is this going to turn out well or not? That's not the sort of omen you'd like to have. Another, a Roman writer, Suetonius, writing just a little after Plutarch, also reports the dream, But in his narrative, fortunately for Caesar, there's a seer or diviner on hand to interpret the dream. And he says, your mother represents Mother Earth. And what that means by sleeping with your mother is that you will dominate the whole Earth. So you will become emperor of either, if not the whole Earth as we know it.
What would be the Latin word for spin?
Yeah, exactly. Caesar was Pontifex Maximus. Caesar was head of the College of Priests that sort of oversaw all religious ritual in Rome. And so we can see that even at his level, very willing to spin an omen or find an omen that went his way.
So this is really all or nothing, because if he loses, of course, he'll lose his life. If he wins, the control of Rome and the Republic is at stake?
It's hard to say. That's how it turns out. But was he thinking more like Sulla was thinking? I'm going to go back. I'm going to claim my political right. I'm going to set things in order. And then Sulla set aside the dictatorship. He voluntarily stepped down. The dictatorship, although it sounds very ominous to us, was a regular office in the Roman Republic. It was when things got out of hand and the regular magistrates couldn't handle it, the Senate would vote to set up a dictator for a fixed period of time. And that dictator would have sort of all power to fix things, and then he would set power down. And so Sulla just went back, took control, took this office, fixed things the way he thought they should be arranged, and then set it aside. And it's hard to know what Caesar actually had in mind at this point. Was he expecting his opponents to back down and give him what he demanded? Was he expecting perhaps to gain control for a short time? As it turns out, he ended up fighting a series of wars across the Mediterranean, in Greece, in Alexandria, Egypt, in Africa, and in Spain. And by the time he's done, he's defeated many, many Romans in battles, maybe fought as many battles against Romans as he fought against foreign armies.
When did he say, I came, I saw, I conquered?
He said that in the midst of all of this. Again, he was a very busy and ambitious man. He chased Pompey and the Republican army, we'd say the army that was loyal to the Republic, into Greece, defeated Pompey there, chased Pompey to Alexandria, Egypt, where Pompey was assassinated before Caesar arrived. And then on his way back to Rome, he stops off in Syria, fights a little war. It was so fast, he came up with that little quip, "Wani, weedy, weeky" in Latin, I came, I saw, I conquered. And that was a quip that when he came back to Rome and had his triumphal parade, that was put on a poster or a sign and carried along with him.
So he had a sense of PR even then.
Definitely. It goes back to these commentaries and the presentation. All Romans were very aware that how you presented yourself and how people thought of you was critical to your career and how it would go.
What about the name Caesar, the use of that term?
Again, another interesting tidbit. It was just a name up to that point. Most Roman men had three names, and Caesar's was Gaius Julius Caesar. Julius, his middle name, was the name of a large clan, and Caesar would be the family name within that clan. And in fact, the Julii were traced back to a man named Iulus or Julus, who was the son of Aeneas, the mythical founder of Rome, and the son of the goddess Venus. So Caesar actually, with a straight face, actually claimed descent from the goddess Venus through his family of the Julii. But that was part of the PR of claiming this. And all Romans would do this, talk about the exploits of their ancestors, how they had been consul, how they had been great generals. And they would actually keep the funeral masks that were made when these ancestors died, they would keep them hung in their house, and they would bring them out on family occasions, maybe other funerals, and talk about the exploits of their family. And they would use this, the reputation of their family, to be elected to further office.
I guess it was later, slightly later, that the tradition came or the notion came that when a Roman emperor died, he turned into a god.
Mm-hmm. And Caesar begins that tradition. Again, Caesar wasn't the emperor because there was no empire yet. There was still the Republic. And we'll get to the assassination. But after Caesar, the Republic is back until his adopted son, Octavian, who eventually becomes Augustus, steps forward and sort of emerges as the single man who is in charge of things. And he, for a long time, is thought of as the first emperor. It's not until we get into the 2nd century AD with writers like Suetonius who start to look back and put Caesar at the first of this line of emperors. And again, so that's a retrospective look at what Caesar had done as opposed to what he thought he was doing and what his contemporaries thought.
Well, before we get to the Ides of March and what we know happens to Caesar, what would you say is the most important accomplishment that he made during his time at the top?
I guess I can think of two things. Maybe one is a little frivolous. But the main thing is, and again, it's the thing he may not have realized he was doing, and that was to make it so that the Republic, the institutions of the Republic, and the Republic had a Senate, had the consuls, a pair of consuls as head of state, and then it had a tribal assembly that would vote on things, didn't really work anymore. And so even after he was assassinated and people had hopes that the Republic would reemerge, it was clear that that was not going to work. And that's what gave the opening for his adopted son, Octavian, to step forward into that vacuum and make it so that the Romans actually never even would look back to the Republic. If they did, it was sort of with a sense of nostalgia and also a sense that the empire was sort of meant to happen. And it was a natural flow from Republic to empire. So I would think, I would say that that was probably the most important thing that he did. The other thing is a little sort of less grand is he took the initiative to institute lots of reforms, including the calendar. And the calendar we use today is really the calendar put in place by Julius Caesar. We talk about the Julian calendar. That's his. It was reformed again in the Middle Ages, and the Julian calendar today is, I think, 13 days behind the one we currently use. But the reform is basically his, and the month of July is named after him.
Well, you know, another little PR maneuver on his part.
Exactly.
Now, you said, Jeff, that he defeated a series of Roman generals after he crossed the Rubicon in this fateful decision. How did that – and it was a – what we call a civil war?
Civil war,
that's right. For a number of years. How did that actually lead to him becoming the head of the Roman state? Did that have to become his goal after a while?
Again, because the institutions of the Republic were simply not working anymore. And so in order to run the state in the way he wanted it to be run, he took a series of offices. First, he would be elected or appointed consul. So he took a regular office. And then he took the office of dictator, which again was a regular office, but held for a particular period of time. And then toward the end of his life, and this is probably what precipitated the end of his life, he took the office of dictator for life. And so he took what was a legitimate office and he sort of warped it and extended it beyond its original intention.
And how could he do that?
Seems like a danger when you have a dictator, doesn't it?
He can do it because there's no – just like the British today, there was no written constitution. And so the Romans depended very, very heavily on tradition. Things had always worked the way they worked and that's why they did them. The Romans were very superstitious when it came to their religion. You know, they had rituals that had always been done, and even if they couldn't explain them, they were afraid to change them. And their government worked in the same sort of way. It had been that way for so long that people just respected that. But that is also what opened the door for someone like Caesar to say, I'm not going to do it that way. And there was no document that said there can only be two consuls or this or that.
What about the trappings of being the dictator for life? Did you get to wear a special outfit?
There were trappings already that people think maybe dated back to the time. There was a monarchy early on when Rome first was developing. And yeah, the consuls had what were called lictors, and these would be essentially a bodyguard, and they would carry these sort of imposing bundles of rods with axes in them, and it was a demonstration of their authority, and the axe symbolized their sort of life and death power while they held this office. But it was just like with our president, it was a symbol of the office rather than the person, and when you stepped out of that office after your year, the next person got it. But when you become dictator for life, you start to hold on to these things, and they become attracted to you. And to get back to the question then about the name, the name Caesar is just a name for Caesar, but afterward, there's a dynasty established after his son Octavian, and that runs through Nero, all having Caesar in their name, and it becomes regular then for the name Caesar to denote the man who is head of the Roman government.
Which is where Kaiser and Tsar both come
exactly
from.
Exactly right. So. And so it's become sort of synonymous with the name of the office as opposed to the individual.
Did he also have a Praetorian Guard?
He did not. That's
a
later development.
A later perk with
that's right.
The office.
And Augustus rules, let's say, from 27 BC when he makes an agreement with the Senate that he will be the leading man in the state and oversee things until his death in AD 14. So quite a long time. And that actually helps the Republic turn into an empire because by the time he dies, no one really remembers about the Republic. It's been so long, a generation has passed. And so that allows the Romans to more comfortably start to institute some of these things that will become a regular part of any monarchy.
We're heading toward the Ides of March when we return in a moment with the University of the Year. If a friend demand why Brutus rose against Caesar, this is my answer, not that I love Caesar less, but that I loved Rome more. Remarks of Brutus in Shakespeare's version of Julius Caesar. I'm Emily Auerbach, back with Norman Gilliland, and our guest is Jeffrey Benneker. We're talking about Julius Caesar on these Ides of March. Brutus seems tormented about what to do with Julius Caesar. Does Brutus represent Roman people in general? Was there a lot of concern as Julius Caesar pronounced himself dictator for life?
I think the concern was probably mostly confined to the upper class, those who had been pushed out of power, who had opposed Caesar's civil war. In fact, Brutus had been on the other side, on Pompey's side in the civil war. But one of the things Caesar was famous for was clemency, forgiving the Romans who fought against him. Those that weren't killed in the battle were forgiven and allowed to come back. And so Brutus was actually allowed to come back and to assume a fairly important position in the government again.
Was Shakespeare also right when he talks about the men around Caesar? I mean, do we have a sense that he's too trusting?
In the ancient literature, he's definitely accused of that, in making a mistake in allowing these men to come back and get too close to him. Because these men, in fact, did harbor a strong feeling for the Republic, not just because they had been put out of power, but because they thought that's the way it should operate. The Republic was set up as we call it checks and balances or separation of powers. It was really meant to keep any one individual from running the Roman state too completely. And Caesar had thwarted this as he became dictator for life. So there were people who were legitimately interested in restoring the institutions of the Republic. And I think Brutus was one of them. But and I think the tension that shows up in the play is there because also favored by Caesar, a friend of Caesar, and there's the story, it's pretty well documented that Caesar had a lengthy affair over many years with Servilia, the mother of Brutus, and there's the rumor that Brutus might actually have been his son. Whether that's a later story or something that was on Brutus's mind, it does show that there was a closeness among all these people. Rome, in the end, although it was a big city, was a fairly small place when it came to the government. All these men had known each other for a long, long time and had been contesting with one another for a long, long time.
Do you think Julius Caesar was well aware of assassination plots building against him?
In the ancient literature, he is. And again, this is written from a retrospective account. He may have been feeling a little bit invincible. He had done a lot in Gaul, and he's famous for fighting in the front lines. Much like Alexander the Great, who he's compared to, had an idea perhaps that fortune was working with him, or perhaps that he was even pushing fortune along to do what he wanted to do. So he may have had a feeling that, yes, it was dangerous, but I'm Caesar and I can survive it as well.
I guess they call that hubris, don't they?
They call it hubris, yeah.
Did he do anything to buy the love of the people, though? Wouldn't that be the first thing he'd have to do, assuming he has somehow curried the favor of those others in power? But doesn't he really have to somehow win the people over in order to stay in power?
He does, and he'd been working on that since his early career with these land reforms and being a popularis or a populist. He also, it turns out, and there's a fantastic scene again in Shakespeare's play where after his funeral, Antony gives in Shakespeare, the friends, Romans, countrymen speech, and he actually did address the people. And it turns out that Caesar had left a substantial, in his will, had left a substantial inheritance to every Roman citizen. And so between that, which came out later, but the games and the other festivities he put on during that period while he was dictator, he did quite a bit to keep the people on his side.
So tell us about the plot then, the actual plot to kill Julius Caesar, and why on the Ides of March?
The Ides of March become significant later. Caesar had been warned by other seers that something was going to happen on that day. And there's the famous line where the seer who made the warning is standing in the street as Caesar's walking to the meeting of the Senate. And he says, "The Ides of March have come." And the seer says back to him, "Yes, but they haven't gone." And he and his wife had terrible dreams the night before. But he goes, and these men have arranged that in the meeting of the Senate, and the Senate on this day was meeting in a room in a theater that Pompey had built. So he's meeting in this complex built by his old political rival, and they've got a plot underway. Again, it's a plot to restore the Republic. It's not a plot necessarily to assassinate Caesar, although they need to move him to restore the Republic. And Brutus and another man named Cassius are the ringleaders, the ones who are organizing it, pushing it forward.
Nobody, I gather, speaks out very vociferously before this point? Or are there writers or political commentators who say, you know, Caesar really has stepped beyond the bounds here and we need to do something without necessarily espousing assassination?
There's not a lot of pressure. And again, people are not quite sure necessarily how far he's going to go. How long will he hold on to these offices? Again, the precedent of Sulla is probably in their minds. Is he going to hold this for a while, stabilize things, and then put the Republic back? Because it is the case that the Republic was broken. And if he had not taken one of these offices and run things, who knows where things might have gone from there. So it was a bit of a mixed bag in terms of liking Caesar and disliking Caesar. He was providing some sort of service for the Republic, and on the other hand, sort of violating the principles on which the Republic was founded.
And how old is Julius Caesar at this point as he's heading toward this meeting of the Senate?
He's in his 50s. He's in his mid-50s.
56.
Yeah.
And tell us how they describe the actual event.
And again, we don't have a firsthand account, but we have a very vivid account from Suetonius writing about the year 120 AD. Let me point out to you before I start to read it that it's not just Shakespeare who dramatizes these things, but there's an idea that events from Roman history very soon appeared on the Roman stage. They would be dramatized. And when you listen to the write-up of this scene of the assassination of Caesar, you can imagine that maybe it has its origins in a dramatic presentation of the assassination of Caesar. There's lots of action, there are characters, and it's very easy to visualize what's going on in the scene. So let me just start by reading from Suetonius. When he was seated, the conspirators gathered around him, as if to show their respect. And immediately, Tilius Cimber, who had taken on the task of initiating the action, came up close to Caesar, as though about to make a request. When Caesar shook his head and waved him away, putting off his business for another time, Cimber grabbed his toga at the shoulders. Caesar then cried out, "But this is force!" And one of the Casca brothers stabbed him from behind, just below the throat. Caesar grabbed Casca's arm and ran him through with a writing implement, but, as he tried to leap forward, he was held back by another wound. When he realized that he was being attacked on all sides with drawn daggers, he wrapped his toga around his head, at the same time using his left hand to pull it down over his thighs, so that, with the lower part of his body also covered, his fall would be more decent. And so it was that he was stabbed 23 times, saying nothing and letting out merely a single groan at the first blow. Though some people relate that when Marcus Brutus came at him, he said, "Caesu technon?" "You too, my child?" He lay lifeless for some time, after everyone had run off, until three young slaves put him on a litter and carried him home, one arm dangling.
That's quite convincing, isn't it? The little details there.
Yeah,
the one arm dangling in particular makes it sound almost like an eyewitness account.
Like an eyewitness, and it adds a little bit, I think, to the pathos. At the end, I think you feel a little bit of sympathy for Caesar, as you can imagine him lying dead on this thing, sort of with his arm dragging.
Well, it's so brutal. And then also there's that detail added about him trying to keep himself decent as he fell, you know, as if somehow preserving his dignity at this moment of attack.
And I think it says a lot about the impression that people had of Julius Caesar, if not about Caesar himself, that very much aware of who he was and what was happening, and therefore realizing very quickly that he was going to end up a corpse on the ground and wanting to be something presentable, something that would still be, if not awe-inspiring, at least something venerable, even in his death.
There's no mention in that account of anybody coming to his aid.
That's right.
Why?
A good question. Most of the senators, he has 23 wounds, so a good number of the men are in on it. There's a question about Mark Antony, whether he knew about it or not. There was a debate whether to bring him in, and in the end he's not brought in. But was it in his best interest to have Caesar removed or not? He really emerges as one of the major players in Roman politics afterward. It may be that even Caesar's friends were ready for him to move on. It's hard to say.
And et tu, Brute? Did he say that or did he say something in Greek?
Yeah, it looks like, according to this, Caesu technon, not only is he saying something in Greek, but he's quoting the opening words of a line of poetry that goes on to say, "And you too, my child, will someday taste of power." And he seems to be saying to Brutus, not even you, Brutus, but one day, Brutus, you'll be in my shoes as well. And it is the case that as a result of Brutus's role in the assassination, he becomes a leader of the resistance to the Caesarian party, which lives on, but also ends his life ends on the battlefield at Philippi.
What sort of public outcry was there against this act of assassination, or was it met with celebration?
It was mixed. It was first met with a little bit of celebration, but then after Mark Antony begins sort of an impromptu funeral speech and holds up the cloak that Caesar was wearing and shows it bloodied and full of holes and reveals that Caesar had left quite a bit of money in his will for the people, public sentiment turns towards the Caesarian party and against the assassins who end up by agreement. They make an agreement, but they have to slip out of Rome for their own protection. And they never really mount a serious opposition again to the men who've come after Caesar. There is still plenty of debate in Rome about restoring the Republic and how that should happen. But in terms of these men who led the assassination, they're not safe in Rome anymore.
So Caesar Augustus really, it's up to him to put things back together.
That's right.
This is a crucial moment, isn't it, for the Roman state?
It is, and it's a moment that lasts for well over a decade when Caesar Augustus, or Octavian at the time, is adopted. It's done in Caesar's will. And so as a 19, 20-year-old man, he finds out that he's become the son of Julius Caesar. And most people dismiss him, especially Mark Antony, who would like to move into Caesar's position. But Octavian comes to Rome and demonstrates pretty clearly that he intends to take all of his inheritance, and not just the money, but the power, the name, and everything. And he becomes a contender for the most powerful position in Rome. And what happens is sort of a repeat of what happened with Caesar and Pompey. The Senate is happy to use Octavian and promote him as a way of pushing back against Antony. But Octavian double-crosses them and signs an agreement with Antony, and they take out as a pair. In fact, they bring in another man, Lepidus, and form the second triumvirate, take out all of their enemies by agreement.
Any significance to Ides other than that it means 15th or the middle of a month?
It means the middle. Yeah, it's the normal Roman way of dating. They put special significance on the calends, the first day of the month, the nones, which were either the 7th or the 9th, and then the Ides, which were either the 13th or in March, the 15th. And so it's just the dates, but again, it looms large, like July 4th or something like that.
So do we have a sense that Rome would be different how because of the death of Caesar?
If Caesar had lived, as opposed to if Caesar had lived on, I suppose it was inevitable that Caesar would die, because everyone who had come before him, who had sort of pushed the limits, had one way or another not survived. And it was really Octavian who gets over that hump, so to speak, who not only reforms the government but lives to die a natural death, that is what allows the Republic to turn into an empire. There had been political assassinations, several of them, before Julius Caesar's time. So again, he's one in a series, but in some ways, not quite the last, but maybe the last big name to die in this way. The process is smoothed out by Octavian, who is smart enough not to become dictator for life and not to declare himself emperor, but to take a normal position, which is called princeps, the leading man. And there had been a princeps, a man with the most sort of influence or authority for many, many years, for centuries, and sort of take a role of great influence in the state without demanding an office. And so he could keep the, even if it was a mirage, he could keep the Republic and all the offices running so he wasn't tearing down the Constitution. But at the same time, he was clearly in charge of things.
He certainly became influential posthumously, Caesar did, when it came to later generals and heads of state.
And as I understand it, I'm not a military historian by any means, but Napoleon, for example, was very interested and actually visited the battlefields that Caesar writes about and criticizes even Caesar's actions and the way he handled certain campaigns.
And became emperor for life himself, Napoleon.
That's right.
What do you think is the most important thing to remember about Julius Caesar?
I think one of the most important things to remember is that he's been invested posthumously with a lot of influence that, or a lot of intention, let's say, that he may or may not have had. He was certainly a product of his times, but he certainly pushed events forward as well. And so I think it's a good lesson when looking at history in general to realize that there's always ambiguity around events, and it's not until later that we can sort things out. And oftentimes we like to impose order and structure onto events of the past that wasn't necessarily there. It certainly makes them easier to study, but sometimes it makes us feel more confident about our own ambiguous times if we think there's some sort of order or structure that maybe we just don't recognize. But I think Caesar was in a very fluid position and always acted according to instinct, and mostly it worked out, and sometimes it didn't work out for him. He gets himself into lots of trouble in Gaul, for example, at moments, even though overall what he does up there is very successful and very brilliant.
Was his name ever invoked by subsequent Roman heads of state, you know, in the spirit of Caesar, or I'm doing this in a tradition set by Caesar?
It's a very tricky thing, because he is the man who destroyed the Republic for a long time. And so even his son, Octavian, who becomes Augustus, keeps him a bit at arm's length. And that's why when people, Romans, write about the emperors, Caesar is sort of left in a liminal position, sort of on the edge. But it's not until the 2nd century AD when people start to respect what he did. They're far enough removed, 150 years or more removed, and so Caesar becomes a safer figure, and he takes his place at the beginning of the line of Caesars, the beginning of the line of emperors. And as the Roman emperors of that period start to expand and fight to extend the emperor, he becomes more of a role model than for the things that he did. But when it came to looking for a role model for good government, Caesar was not necessarily your man.
And the assassins, heroes or villains?
A bit of both. In the aftermath, Cicero, who's still around until he's murdered by agreement between Antony and Octavian is holding them up as defenders of liberty, the men who were brave enough to step forward when the Republic was being threatened. And Cicero saw himself as a great defender of the Republic and naturally admired other people who did the same sort of thing.
Our guest has been Jeff Beneker, and I cannot think of a more suitable one for these Ides of March than someone who could enlighten us about Julius Caesar. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you very much. I really enjoyed it.
I'm Norman Gilliland with Emily Auerbach, and I hope you can join us for the next hour of University of the Air.